Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Kaz.
And I'm Em. And in today's episode, we're focusing on a particularly disturbing form of biblical violence, and that's child sacrifice. Now, as we've already seen in previous episodes of this podcast, there's a lot of violence in the Bible. But when it comes to violence perpetrated against children, particularly in a sacrificial context, it can be especially hard for people to think about, not least of all for those who regard biblical texts as sacred scripture. But I do think it's important that we confront this violence and talk about it, especially when violence against children is far from a thing of the past.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So just to give a content warning right at the start, we'll be talking about the sacrificial killing of children throughout this episode, and we'll also touch on themes relating to child abuse, gender-based violence, and family violence. So if you find these topics too disturbing or confronting, you may want to skip this episode. And as usual, we'll leave a link to some relevant support services in our show notes.
So Em, could you start us off by telling the listeners a bit about the nature of sacrifice more generally in the Bible? What functions did it serve, or what significance did it have?
Sure. So the various meanings and functions of biblical sacrifice are quite complex and intricate, but to give you a general definition, sacrifice is an act of devotion where an offering is made to a deity. This offering can refer to anything that is valuable to the person making the sacrifice, but in biblical texts, it often refers to offerings of grain or wine, or in the case of burnt offerings, it involves the ritual slaughter of a living creature, most often an animal such as a sheep, a bull, a goat, or a dove. But in some cases, the sacrifice appears to have involved the slaughter of a human being.
Could you tell us a bit more about these burnt offerings, what they entailed?
Sure. So in biblical Hebrew, the term that's usually translated as burnt offering is olah.
Now, if I remember my biblical Hebrew correctly, isn't olah related to the verb to rise or to ascend?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The sacrifice, or olah, refers to the smoke from the burnt offering rising up to heaven, where it will be smelt and appreciated by God.
Ah, okay. And what's the purpose of the sacrifice? How does the Bible speak about it in terms of what it actually achieves?
In essence, sacrifice is understood to be a form of communication with a deity. The sacrifice is a gift to the deity, either to give thanks or to fulfill a vow or to make amends for committing a sin or wrongdoing. The hope is that the sacrifice will establish or rejuvenate good relationships with the deity so that the individual or their community will continue to receive the deity's blessing and protection.
So, in other words, offering a sacrifice is a way to say sorry to God for something sinful you've done, or to thank God for something good that's happened, or to try and gain some divine favour or ask God's help when things are going wrong. Is that right?
Yeah, that basically sums it up.
Okay, so you mentioned that animals are most often used to make a burnt offering. Oh, poor animals.
I know, right?
Yeah. But you did say that human sacrifices were also practiced. Now, I'm not sure if all of our listeners will be aware of that. Can you talk us through some of the biblical texts that mention this?
Sure. So the first texts we should look at come from the book of Exodus, chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, and then chapter 22, verse 30. These are both laws that essentially call for firstborn males, both human and other than human, to be consecrated or given to the Lord.
Consecrated as in sacrificed?
Yeah, many scholars believe so, although others aren't so sure.
But that didn't actually happen, did it? I mean, I can think of plenty of stories in the Bible about firstborn sons, Ishmael, Esau, Samson, Jonathan, to name but a few, and they're not sacrificed to the Lord, are they?
No, you're right. And that could be because Exodus chapter 13 verse 13 and chapter 34 verse 20 both state that firstborn sons could be redeemed by an animal sacrifice.
And what does that mean?
Essentially, rather than consecrating your firstborn son, you offer a replacement sacrifice instead, such as a sheep or other animal.
Okay, so the two texts in Exodus might raise the possibility of child sacrifice, but maybe not. And they also seem to offer an alternative to it.
Mm.
To me, it doesn't seem like very conclusive evidence. Are there any other texts which suggest that child sacrifice was practiced in biblical Israel?
Yeah, there are. Although biblical scholars don't always agree if it was an accepted part of Israelite religion, there are a surprising number of texts that allude to child sacrifice, and we don't have time to go through each and every one of them in detail, but I'll offer a few examples. And if our listeners are keen to learn more about this topic, we'll list some useful resources in our show notes.
That sounds a good idea.
So, let's start with some texts that appear to call out and condemn the practice of child sacrifice taking place in Israel. Kaz, could you read out Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 31 for us, please?
Sure. So Moses is warning the Hebrews that they must not start adopting the religious practices of the Canaanites, whose land they are about to colonize. He says, "You must not do the same as them for the Lord your God, because every abhorrent thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. They would even burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods." Okay, that seems to be clear enough. Deuteronomy is saying that child sacrifice is a Canaanite practice that the Hebrews must not adopt or imitate.
Essentially, yes. And again, in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 10, we read, "No one shall be found among you who makes a son or daughter pass through fire." This language of putting your offspring in the fire or through the fire comes up in a number of other texts, such as 2 Kings, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and the book of Psalms. But just to give an example, could you read out Jeremiah chapter 19, verses 4 to 5, please, Kaz?
Certainly. So God is speaking to Jeremiah about the people of Jerusalem, who he says, quote, "have filled this place with the blood of the innocent and gone on building the high places of Baal to burn their children in the fire as burnt offerings to Baal, which I did not command or decree, nor did it enter my mind." Okay, so it sounds as though Jeremiah is trying to completely disassociate the God of Israel and the religion of Israel from child sacrifice here. Do you think that's the case?
It could be. Although Jeremiah brings up this issue of child sacrifice on three separate occasions, which suggests that the practice was happening in Israel at the time. But it's interesting that he frames it as a foreign practice, not something related to the worship of Israel's God. Jeremiah associates it with the worship of the Canaanite deity Baal, and in other texts it's linked to the, quote, "abominable practices of the nations."
And do we know if child sacrifice did happen in Canaan, or the wider region of ancient Southwest Asia?
Yeah, we're pretty sure it did, in some regions at least. Archaeological evidence suggests that child sacrifice may have been practiced in Phoenicia and the Phoenician colony of Carthage, which is modern-day Tunisia. And in the biblical text of 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 27, we read that when he was struggling to win a battle against the Israelites, the Moabite king Mesha, quote, "took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him, and offered him as a burnt offering."
Right there and then? In the midst of the battle?
Yeah, and according to the narrator, the sacrifice seemed to work, in that the Israelite army immediately withdrew.
Wow, so the text is basically confirming that child sacrifice does work. It effectively caused Israel's God to withdraw the Israelite army, just as King Mesha intended.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Now, there are also a few biblical texts that seem to mention child sacrifice in reference to someone or something called Molech. Could you read Leviticus chapter 20, verses 1 to 3 out for us, please, Kaz?
Sure. "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say further to the Israelites, any of the Israelites or of the aliens who reside in Israel who give any of their offspring to Molech shall be put to death. The people of the land shall stone them to death. I myself will set my face against them and will cut them off from the people, because they have given their offspring to Molech, defiling my sanctuary and profaning my holy name." Okay, so the law is prohibiting people from giving their offspring to Molech in the strongest terms. And I presume that means some form of child sacrifice. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, do we know if this practice was actually happening in Israel?
Well, we're told in 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 10, that King Josiah defiled and destroyed the Topheth, the place where child sacrifices took place, quote, so that no one would make a son or a daughter pass through fire for Molech. This verse seems to confirm that child sacrifices had been happening, so Josiah put a stop to it as part of his wider religious reforms. But despite his efforts, it seems to have continued because in Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 35, the prophet complains that the Israelites are involved with Molech again, quote, they built the high places of Baal in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to offer up their sons and daughters to Molech. Though I did not command them, nor did it enter my mind that they should do this abomination, causing Judah to sin.
It's quite hard to tell from the texts that you've read out whether Molech is the name of a deity or if it's the name of a kind of ritual. What do biblical scholars say about that?
Quite a few scholars have suggested that Molech is the name of a foreign deity, and that the Israelites adopted Molech worship after being influenced by their Canaanite neighbours.
It's very interesting because I have come across the name Moloch, M-O-L-O-C-H, being mentioned by members of the US religious right to refer to an, air quotes, pagan deity or demon who is worshipped by the enemy, i.e. the Democrats. Back in 2019, Fox News radio host Todd Starnes was actually sacked after claiming on air that Democrats do not believe in the Christian God, but instead worship Moloch. And I've heard of other far-right pundits accusing Democrats of being Moloch worshippers if they support such things as LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights. But getting back to the Bible, tell me, Em, do any biblical scholars suggest that Moloch isn't the name of a foreign deity?
Yeah, some scholars, including Otto Einsfeld and Francesca Stavrakopoulou, suggest that the Hebrew term actually refers to a form of ritual that involves the sacrifice of children to Israel's deity.
Oh, do you think that's plausible?
Yeah, I do think we have to take it seriously, not least because there are texts where child sacrifice is described explicitly as being done at God's behest or in God's name. Kaz, can you think of any texts that refer to child sacrifice happening in biblical Israel?
Yeah, absolutely. The two that come to my mind are the sacrifice of Jephthah's daughter in Judges 11 and the near sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis 22.
Yeah, they're definitely two of the most well-known cases in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. Let's take a closer look at both these texts, starting off with Isaac.
Okay.
Could you read out the opening verses of Genesis chapter 22, please, Kaz?
Certainly. So Genesis 22 begins with God telling Abram, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. And then we're simply told that Abraham follows God's orders. Now, I have a question. Does God give Abraham a reason for why he's got to sacrifice Isaac? It just seems like such a huge thing for him to ask.
No, God doesn't give any reason. So it's a mystery why Abraham seems to comply without question.
And I suppose it doesn't help that Abraham barely speaks throughout this narrative, so we can't really tell what he's thinking or feeling. But he does seem totally prepared to go through with God's command. Because if we read on, once he and Isaac reach the sacrifice site, he methodically builds an altar, arranges the wood on top of it, ties up his son, and lays him on top of the wood. He's literally poised with a dagger in his hand, ready to kill poor Isaac, when right at the 11th hour, the angel of the Lord stops him in his tracks.
Yeah, it's all very last minute, isn't it? Do you want to read out what the angel says, Kaz?
Sure. The angel says, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abram looked up and saw a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. Abram went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. Whoa, that's a very, very intense scene.
Yeah, it really is. And there's no doubt that Abraham's willingness to go through with the sacrifice has proven his true devotion to the God of Israel. The angel's words make that really clear. this is not a Canaanite deity leading Abraham astray with unethical foreign practices. This is Abraham's own God, who sees nothing wrong with demanding child sacrifice as a mark of obedience and loyalty.
It really is a text of terror, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
But the terror in it often gets overlooked, or it's interpreted as something far more wholesome, like a gentle reminder that God expects people to make personal sacrifices. I've also come across some interpretations that suggest Genesis 22 is a polemic against child sacrifice, but I'm not convinced that's reflected in the text.
No, neither am I. There's absolutely no attempt to problematize child sacrifice here. It's something that God is free to demand, and his followers seem unable to refuse this demand. And the angel even seems to congratulate Abraham for being willing to slaughter his son.
Yeah, that's so true.
So I agree, Kaz. The terror in this text is far too often ignored by biblical readers and biblical scholars. It's as though we've become numb to this story. We don't question it. We don't see it as a story of abuse. We tell this story to our kids at Sunday school. We don't react at all to the monstrousness of the situation.
Yes, we so often overlook Isaac's trauma, don't we? I mean, what on earth would he be thinking here? Would he ever trust his father again? Would he ever sleep easy in his bed, knowing that his dad was perfectly prepared to tie him up and slaughter him, all in the name of proving his fidelity to God? It's a very, very disturbing text.
Yeah, it seems to me that while Abraham didn't sacrifice Isaac's life, he did sacrifice Isaac's sense of safety and bodily integrity. And I wonder too if Abraham also sacrificed his own relationship with his son.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wonder, yeah.
So Isaac did escape the fate of becoming a burnt offering. But not all Israelite children are quite so lucky. You mentioned Jephthah's daughter, Kaz, so let's take a look at her story.
That sounds like a good idea.
At the start of Judges 11, we meet the mighty warrior Jephthah. Now, during an ongoing conflict with the Ammonite people, Jephthah makes a vow to God where he promises that if God helps Jephthah win the battle against the Ammonites, then whatever or whoever comes out of his house to meet him on his return home, he will offer it up to God as a burnt offering. God obviously decides to accept this vow, and the next thing we're told is that God has helped Jephthah to defeat the Ammonite army.
Okay, so far so good.
Yes, but then things start to go very badly wrong for Jephthah. God has kept his side of the bargain, so now Jephthah has to fulfill his promise to sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house. But when he gets home, who comes running out to greet him but his only daughter celebrating her father's return with music and dancing?
Does Jephthah's daughter have a name, Em?
She may have had, but we're not told what it is. She's just referred to as Jephthah's daughter throughout this whole story.
And do we know how old she was?
Again, the text doesn't say, but given that she's still unmarried and living in her father's house, she was likely still pretty young, maybe early to mid-teens or even younger.
Okay, so essentially still a child.
Yeah. Now, Jephthah is understandably distraught, but his daughter tells him not to worry. She insists that he should fulfill his vow and sacrifice her. The only thing she asks is that he waits 2 months so that she can go up into the mountains with her female companions and bewail or mourn her virginity. When she comes back, we're simply told that Jephthah, quote, did with her according to the vow he had made.
So this sounds like another tragic text of terror.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a question for you. When Jephthah made his vow, did it not occur to him that his daughter might be the first one to come out of the house? I mean, who did he think he might have to sacrifice?
Yeah, that question has been debated a lot by biblical scholars. Certainly, he could have thought an animal might greet him.
An animal coming out of his house? Do you mean a pet?
No, not necessarily. We do know that in ancient Israelite houses, people tended to live on the upper floors and the animals lived on the lower floors. So it's possible that Jephthah presumed an animal fit for sacrifice, like a sheep or a goat, might emerge from the house first.
But the way he words his vow doesn't sound as though he's referring to an animal. He says he will sacrifice whoever or whatever comes out of the house to meet him. Mm. That to me suggests he was thinking about another human being. I can't think of another biblical text where a sheep or a goat comes out to meet its owner.
No, neither can I. And there's another reason why he should have anticipated that his daughter or another woman in the household might run out first, especially given he's been away in battle.
Oh, what reason is that?
So there seems to be a precedent for biblical women coming out of their houses to greet returning war heroes. A good example is 1 Samuel 18, where we're told many women came out into the streets singing and dancing and playing musical instruments when King Saul and David returned from a successful battle against the Philistines.
Okay, so let me get this clear in my head. We can be fairly certain that Jephthah didn't plan to sacrifice his daughter, given his horrified reaction when he sees her, but we can't rule out that he didn't have a human sacrifice in mind when he made that vow.
Yeah, that's correct.
And he obviously believed that the promise of a sacrifice, be it human or other than human, would bring him divine favour on the battlefield.
Yeah, and it's clear from this story that God did seem pleased at the prospect of a sacrifice, whether human or other than human. God gave Jephthah what he wished for, and God seemed to accept the burnt offering in return. Unlike with Isaac, God does nothing to stop the sacrifice of Jephthah's daughter from taking place, and nor does Jephthah suffer any divine repercussions for making the sacrifice.
And are we absolutely sure that he followed through with the sacrifice? Does the text make that clear?
Well, some biblical scholars have suggested that Jephthah might have redeemed her by offering an animal sacrifice in her place, or perhaps he consecrated her as a priestess in the temple. But unfortunately, there's no evidence of that in the text. And neither do these theories tie in with what we're told in verse 39, which says, quote, "He did with her according to the vow he had made." And his vow explicitly stated that he'd sacrifice whoever came out of his house as a burnt offering.
Do you think this text is critical of what Jephthah did? I mean, could Judges 11 be read as a polemic against child sacrifice?
It's hard to say, but I'm not sure there's much evidence for that. There's no explicit condemnation of what Jephthah does. To be sure, he suffers the repercussions of his vow by losing his only daughter. But at the same time, readers are reminded that vows involving human sacrifices actually work. God clearly accepts them. Just like King Mesha of Moab, Jephthah won his war because he promised his deity a burnt offering, and his deity delivered on that promise. And as Jewish studies scholar John Levinson points out, Jephthah's act of sacrificing his only daughter only makes sense if we assume that it was a legitimate way to fulfill his vow.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So clearly human sacrifice was acceptable in the context of this story, and I don't think the narrator does anything to critique this.
Could you argue that the text teaches us the terrible repercussions of making such a vow?
Sure, but that lesson only works because the chosen sacrifice happened to be his daughter. If the child of an enslaved member of Jephthah's household had come out first, I doubt Jephthah would have felt nearly as bad or even given it a second thought.
So maybe the real lesson of this text isn't that child sacrifice per se is wrong, but that people who make vows should think them through more carefully before making them, because they're irrevocable, they can't be broken.
But even then, there are other biblical texts where vows and oaths do get broken without any obvious repercussions.
Oh, can you give us an example?
Sure. So later on in Judges, in chapter 17, we read about a man called Micah, whose mother utters an oath against the person who stole her money. Micah then confesses to her that he was the one who stole it. But rather than her fulfilling the curse against him, she simply says to him, "May my son be blessed by the Lord." And he gives her back the money.
Oh, that ended well.
Yeah, it did. There's another story in 1 Samuel 14, where Saul swears an oath that all his troops must abstain from food until nightfall. His son Jonathan unwittingly violates the oath by eating some honey, and while Saul initially tells Jonathan that he's going to have to kill him to fulfill the oath, the other soldiers refuse to let him, and they redeem Jonathan instead.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah, so Both of these stories suggest that oaths and vows don't necessarily need to be fulfilled to the letter, which leaves me wondering about Jephthah's statement to his daughter that, quote, I have opened my mouth to the Lord and I cannot take back my vow.
I can only think that he must have genuinely believed that was true. And it wasn't because he didn't care about his daughter. He seemed utterly devastated when he sees her coming out of the house. He tears his clothes, which we know is a biblical expression of grief and mourning.
Yeah, nah. I have an issue with what he said to her.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He sees his dancing, tambourine-playing child coming to meet him, and his first words to her are, Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You have become the cause of great trouble to me. Now, that sounds as though he's blaming her for his own thoughtless vow. She has brought him low. She is the source of great trouble. He refuses to blame himself for putting his daughter in this terrible situation. He doesn't even apologize to her.
Yes, that is really disturbing, as though it's all her fault for coming out of the house to greet her war hero dad. And even she seems to internalize this blame, because the narrator tells us that she ends up comforting her as though he is the real victim of the story. She says to him, My father, if you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth. What do you make of that, Em? What do you make of what she says here?
To be honest, I have quite mixed feelings about her response here, as do many biblical interpreters. Some scholars praise her for being a dutiful daughter and the epitome of piety and obedience, while other scholars criticize her for this very same reason.
Oh, why do they criticize her?
Well, they criticize the way she's characterized in the text as a girl who prioritizes obedience to her father over her own safety and agency. They view it as a patriarchal fantasy of how a man's daughter ought to behave when her father's honor is at stake.
Ah, okay.
I've read some other scholars, though, who suggest that Jephthah's daughter did manage to demonstrate her agency here by freely choosing to sacrifice herself. In other words, she wanted to do it, perhaps to escape her inevitable fate of being a wife and mother.
Really? I'm a bit cynical about the idea that Jephthah's daughter did have any agency, and I'm not sure I'd say that she had a choice exactly either.
Why do you think that?
Well, what else could she do? What were her options? Did she really have the authority and power to say to her father, sorry, nope, I'm not doing it? I just get uncomfortable with interpretations that seem intent on ascribing agency to biblical women and girls who are confronted with the threat of lethal violence, as though they have options open to them and they choose the violent option. It almost feels like victim blaming to me. It reminds me of the air quotes, she was asking for it rhetoric we hear levelled against victims of sexual harm and victims of family violence. All it does is shift the culpability from the perpetrator to the victim. And in the case of Jephthah's daughter, the idea that she has choice and agency only removes the blame from her father. And it also exonerates the patriarchal religion that seems to demand the slaughter of children in exchange for divine favours and blessings.
Yeah, I completely agree. Jephthah's daughter wasn't really given any sort of choice, was she? She was caught between a rock and a hard place, or as biblical scholar Simon Sungai Kim puts it, the daughter of Jephthah was caught between the Almighty God and the patriarchal system of the time, which allowed the virgin daughter to be sacrificed as an innocent bystander.
Oh, that's such a good quote. It really captures things so well. So I have another question for you, Em. Up till now, we've spoken about child sacrifice in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. But is there any mention of it in the New Testament?
Yeah, there is. Child sacrifice is depicted in the New Testament through the crucifixion and death of Jesus.
Okay, so in what sense can we understand Jesus as the victim of a sacrifice?
Well, lots of theologians understand the crucifixion as an event where Jesus is effectively sacrificed. This belief has been informed by earlier understandings of sacrifices as atoning or salvific in some sense.
Okay, but Jesus was crucified by the Romans. He wasn't offered up as a burnt offering on an altar in the same way that Jephthah's daughter likely was.
No, that's right. But in the years that followed the crucifixion, Jesus' early followers sought to give theological meaning to his execution. One of the ways they did this, among others, was to draw on this idea of sacrifice. They began to see Jesus' death as a substitute sacrifice, a willing self-sacrifice of the highest rank in order to re-establish relations with God and to make amends for the sins of all humanity. Jesus became the Passover lamb, the pure and blameless sacrifice used to atone for the sins of others and to redeem them from their sins.
And God, his Father, is he the one who provides Jesus as a sacrifice?
Yeah, that's how many theologians over the millennia have understood Jesus' death, including the Gospel writer John and the Apostle Paul. In John chapter 3, verses 16 to 17, we read the very well-known statement, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life. Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him." And in Romans chapter 3, verses 24 to 25, Paul explains that sinners, quote, "are now justified by God's grace as a gift, through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a sacrifice of atonement by his blood, effective through faith." And in Romans chapter 8, verses 31 to 32, Paul writes, "What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, how will God not also, along with Jesus, graciously give us all things?" So in these texts, Jesus' death seems to be envisioned as a sacrifice mandated by God to atone for the sins of the world. God gave up his own Son to serve as the sacrifice so that others could be saved and their sins forgiven. Now, this is not the only way theologians have interpreted Jesus' death, but it is certainly a predominant way of understanding it.
Okay, so I'm way out of my theological depth here, but do you think Jesus was a willing sacrifice, like Jephthah's daughter is presented?
I think we can say that Jesus grasped the enormity of what such a sacrifice would entail, and he seems to have understood the depth of suffering he'd go through. This comes out clearly in a scene included in some of the Gospels, which occurs just before Jesus' arrest. The scene is usually referred to as the agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. Could you read it out for us, Kaz?
Certainly. I've chosen the version from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 26. So to put it in context, Jesus goes with some of his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane, and we're told that he feels sad and troubled. He tells the disciples, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Then he moves away a bit, falls to the ground, and says the following prayer: "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I want, but as you want." A little later, Jesus prays again: "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." And then we're told he prays the same thing again for a third time. Whoa, this is such a tragic scene, isn't it? Jesus is terrified and filled with such sadness, because he doesn't want to do what God has planned for him, but at the same time, he seems ready to do it, unless God decides otherwise.
Yeah, it's a really heartbreaking scene. In some ways, Jesus echoes Jephthah's daughter in that he doesn't refuse to go ahead with the sacrifice. But unlike Jephthah's daughter, he also prays that God, his Father, will take this obligation from him, but only if it's God's will.
So he's essentially putting it in God's hands to decide whether or not the crucifixion or sacrifice goes ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
I am really glad that this Gethsemane tradition is included in some of the Gospels.
Yeah, why is that, Kaz?
Because it reminds us of the true terror experienced by all those children who are chosen as a sacrifice: Isaac, Jephthah's daughter, the king of Mesha's son, and all the unnamed victims of child sacrifice alluded to in other biblical texts. We never hear about their terror or their urgent prayers to be spared this horrible, horrible fate. Their suffering and trauma is effectively erased from the texts, and it's not always discussed much in biblical interpretation either. But perhaps Jesus' own suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane can remind us to think about these texts of terror from the victim's point of view and to consider the agony that they must have gone through once they realised their fate.
That's such an important point, Kaz, and I hadn't thought of it like that before. I really like the idea of Jesus giving voice, at least in some sense, to the depth of terror felt by victims of child sacrifice. And perhaps there's also a hint of protest and resistance in Jesus' words.
Yeah, that may be true. Jesus is very effectively shining a light on the unimaginable horror of human sacrifice.
Yeah.
So today, neither of the biblical faiths, Judaism and Christianity, endorse child sacrifice in any shape or form as a religious ritual.
No, thank goodness.
But I have one last question for you. Do you think contemporary readers of the Bible can still use biblical texts about child sacrifice, such as Genesis 22 and Judges 11, to reflect on any wider issues within their own communities?
Yeah, I think these texts can help us all reflect on the ways that children today are still sacrificed, metaphorically at least.
Sacrificed in what way?
Not in a religious sense, not at all, but in the sense of being surrendered or destroyed for the benefit of something or someone else.
Could you share an example?
Sure. So I'm thinking particularly of patriarchal institutions, such as the church, which have had a long history of turning a blind eye to the systematic abuse and victimization of children in their communities and in their care. This has come to light over the past few decades, where there's been a growing number of reports about child sexual abuse happening in churches and church-run institutions, such as schools and children's homes. These reports have come from churches across all denominations in North and South America, in the United Kingdom, Ireland, Europe, and here in Australasia. All too often in these cases, the church has stood accused of fostering a culture of concealment about child sexual abuse. The perpetrators, both clergy and lay leaders, are often dealt with in-house rather than being reported to the police, and they're moved on from one parish to another after accusations of their abuse comes to light. We've also heard about victims and their families who have been coaxed or coerced into remaining silent about the abuse on the grounds that it could damage the church's reputation.
That's a really good example, Em.
So, all in all, there's been a complete denial of accountability because the church puts its institutional reputation before the safety and well-being of some of its most vulnerable members. And when I think about that in light of our discussion in this episode, I would say that just as we need to raise awareness about the terror of child sacrifice in biblical texts, we also need to raise our voices in protest about the ongoing sacrifice of children's safety to preserve the patriarchal power and privilege of the church as an institution.
Yeah, I think that is such a helpful way of thinking about the ongoing relevance of these biblical texts. And as I said, it's an excellent example that you've just shared with us. And I'd say that it's not only the church that's still sacrificing children or children's safety. Political and governmental institutions are guilty of it too. I remember we raised this in our episode titled The Disappeared back in season one, where we discussed how thousands of Indigenous children in Canada were subjected to terrible, terrible abuses, all in an effort to scaffold and sustain colonial Christian ideologies of white supremacy. Mm. And similar things still happen today. I'm thinking particularly of the UK government's immigration policies that render refugee and asylum-seeking children incredibly vulnerable to harm, particularly if they're arriving from Southwest Asia or Africa. The UK government is essentially denying these children safe passage with their families. And even when they arrive unaccompanied by their parents, they're still not always offered any meaningful care or protection. I don't know if you read about this, Em, but earlier this year, there were reports of hundreds of unaccompanied refugee children going missing from home office-run hotels in England, where they'd been left to live without adequate supervision or care. Many of these children are feared to have been kidnapped and trafficked by criminal gangs. And I believe that at the time of our recording this episode, a significant number of these children are still missing.
Yeah, it's so troubling, hey?
It is. It's scandalous. Now, most of the children living in these hotels are already incredibly vulnerable, and some will have experienced trafficking and other forms of exploitation even before they arrive in the UK. But rather than looking after them and keeping them safe, the British government prefers to leave them in very unsafe environments where they have limited access to legal help or other forms of protection. So yeah, when we read biblical texts about child sacrifice, perhaps we should think about cases like this and the one you mentioned, Em, where children continue to be sacrificed by governments and religious institutions in an effort to scaffold their own racist or nationalistic or patriarchal ideologies. And just as we describe these biblical stories as texts of terror, I think we should likewise recognise these contemporary accounts of child victimisation as texts of terror too.
So this has been a pretty full-on episode, Kaz.
Yeah.
Shall we end by sharing what we've been reading or listening to this week?
Certainly, yes. I've been watching the TV drama called Three Pines, which was just released last year. It's based on the fabulous novels by Louise Penny and stars British actor Alfred Molina as Chief Inspector Armand Gamache. So the drama is set in the fictional village of Three Pines in Quebec, Canada. And what I really like about it is that it not only includes some very intriguing mysteries and fascinating characters, but it also takes the time to explore the injustices of Canada's colonial history and the violence perpetrated against Indigenous children and their families. It also has a storyline that highlights the endemic of violence experienced by Indigenous women and girls and the failure of the Canadian government and law enforcement to tackle that violence. So I would highly recommend it. My one caveat is that the season ends on a real cliffhanger. And I just learned the other day there is not going to be a season two. So I'm just going to have to buy all the Louise Penny books and read them instead. But which, you know, not a great hardship, to be honest.
Yeah, the Inspector Gamache series has come highly recommended to me from a number of sources now. So I'm really going to have to watch it.
Yeah, you should.
So I've been listening to a podcast called Hoaxed. In 2014, two children told police that they were being abused by a satanic cult headed by their father and other leaders of their community. The podcast tells the story of a modern-day satanic panic, about victims whose lives were destroyed, and about the people who spread this conspiracy all around the world. It's a wild story, but it's a good listen.
Oh, yeah, I have heard of it. I will give it a listen for sure. So thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Bloody Bible. And thank you so much for sticking with us through our discussion of some really troubling texts. As always, the resources we used are listed in our show notes, which you'll find on our website, along with the links to our social media accounts.
But until next time, we'll sign off and say goodbye. Stay safe, everyone.
The Bloody Bible podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. Special thanks to Professor Johannes Diebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us to create the podcast and supported us into this second season. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and myself, Richard Bonifant, who also recorded and edited each episode, whilst apologising profusely on behalf of all men. Our music is Stalker by Alexis Ortiz Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. Our social media links are found in the notes to this episode. Please leave us a 5-star review. Thanks for listening.